Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
Yesterday, of course, was the midterm budget speech. It made us, of course, as it always does, focus on the South African economy. Not a pretty picture at all. Joining us on the line, Deputy Chair of SASFIN, David Shapiro. David, thanks for taking the time to speak to us. How are you?
I'm okay.
Considering. Yeah.
I'm just saying it was an awful day on global markets yesterday. Yeah. So we had a terrible day on the JSE, but it wasn't only aligned to the midterm budget. It was aligned to what was happening in global markets, which is really related to a fresh outbreak of infections, particularly in Europe, and worries that this will cause a second lockdown, which will knock back in a global economy. So it will send us backwards. So market was very jittery yesterday. Mm-hmm. And on top of this, we had the midterm budget. So,
indications,
so if you wake
globally
up with a headache, you understand, you know?
Exactly. If you're not feeling, if there's no spring in your step, you understand why. Yeah, because I see France is looking towards another major lockdown, which of course impacts greatly on the European markets. So, it is.
How are they very nervous just on that. They're very nervous to go for a heavy lockdown. And one of the reasons is that it reinforces inequality. And what we mean by that is blue collar workers can't work from home. You know, so they lose their income and they prejudiced. And it's also, you know, it affects poverty as well. It's poorer workers as well.
Also have to remember that the initial lockdown was in order to, and it certainly worked for a while in South Africa, to allow our health services to be prepared. So,
exactly.
But once that's done, I can't imagine that these hard lockdowns have the benefit that they would have had then. There are other ways in which to do it. Create areas, look at different areas, like they do in China.
Definitely.
You know, they lock down certain suburbs or parts of a city. You don't lock down everything.
Definitely. I think my big gripe, and I've been going on for 7 months about this, is that there's been no coordinated effort globally to address the issue. It's every suburb, every city, every town for themselves, every business for themselves. There hasn't been a coordinated effort to try and control this. And, you know, from my point of view, I think world leadership has let us down dramatically. I'm not pointing at anybody. I'm pointing at everyone. I'm not singling out any leader, but I think generally, and understand this. This is not a financial crisis. This is a health crisis. Therefore, what governments have done is that they've taken income away from consumers. They've taken income away from businesses. And it's actually their obligation to fill that gap. And there again, they've fallen well short of it. So I think they're deep concerns about going backwards. And that's why markets are so shaky at the moment, simply because there doesn't seem to be an algorithm to address this issue. You know, it's not balancing out. So I think.
And I think added to that in South Africa is not only was our economy a pre-existing comorbidity. There's no doubt about that. So was corruption, which then further robbed South Africans not only of money, but of the confidence of knowing that there was at least some, I'll use the word Rachmanis, mercy that the thieves of government would have on the population of South Africa and not steal the money that was needed to assist in this fight. Now when it stands up, what kind of confidence can anybody in government expect the people of the country to have?
No, it's exactly right. You know, you would think in a situation like this that there would be some biblical goodness in people, but not at all. And it just shows you, even in times of stress, everybody's out to make a buck, from wherever they can. But I think you're talking about the midterm budget, and I'm a fan of Tito because I think he's really trying. He's trying under the most difficult, difficult circumstances. And you know that he wants to do things and he knows what has to be done. But I think, I don't think he's got the kind of support, that he does need. But yesterday was a kind of a victory for him because leading up to this midterm budget, leading up to the budget were concerns that there were going to be all kinds of wealth taxes and, other measures, the so-called President's Council or Council of Advisors recommended, you know, that they increase taxes and don't cut back on expenditure. In fact, was the complete opposite of what Tito said yesterday. And that's why we were all on edge. And at the end of the day, there wasn't much detail in what he said, but there certainly weren't the kind of worries about increasing taxes. There are lots of other things to worry about, but not taxes. And it comes back to something you might have alluded to now. In a way, is that when you speak about corruption and you speak about these things, and when they want to tax you more, and in an environment where government has robbed its citizens of money, you don't want, you know, you feel angry. And I think they've sensed the anger of the taxpayers, and it's a very, very small base that they would call on.
That's interesting, because that's exactly what I was alluding to, is how could you possibly go and ask people for, people who are struggling anyway, for more money, to make more sacrifices when there isn't the confidence that you're not going to, that you'll use that money responsibly or won't steal it.
That's exactly. And that's why I think there's going to be a great reluctance to increase, taxes of any nature. You know, small maybe next year. They did say, next year, 5 billion and thereafter 10 billion, 10 billion, 15 billion. Over the next few years. But I think the base is already stretched. You know, this will fall on a couple of 100,000 taxpayers in a population of 59 million. So I think they understand, I think government understands this, that listen, we can't stretch this anymore. Also what happens is that you send people out the country. You know, those people who've got the skills, feel the frustration, say, look, if I'm going to have to work this hard, I'd rather do it in the UK, Canada, Israel, Australia, New Zealand, wherever.
There's a danger of almost reaching a tipping point where people say, and obviously every individual has their own tipping point, but we also have a collective one where collective consciousness gets together and says that, you know what, enough. You know, we saw that ETOL being a prime example of that. SABC looking to demand, license fees for Netflix. People are using, these are things too far, I believe.
The one thing that they're not pulling back on is SAA.
I was going to ask you about that. It's become
like an obsession. I don't know why the obsession is there. Whether Pravin is making a last stand on SAA and doesn't want to go down like a sinking ship, but it doesn't make sense. You know, and what's happening, the worst, is that in order to fund this 10 billion, they've already funded 16 billion earlier on in the year, this extra 10 billion is not going to come from fresh money. It's coming from existing budget. So they'll take away from policing. They're taking away from education. They're taking away from health in order to save SAA. But that seems to be, kind of the Achilles heel or a soft underbelly of government. You know, they're not going to let up on this one.
But more than that is it's virtually impossible to follow the SAA narrative. And maybe I haven't put enough effort into it, but you know what? I do have a day job, but I can't follow it. It's impossible to know over the last couple of years what the policy actually is.
No one really understands. And that's why there's such an outcry over this 10 billion. But government seem to be adamant that they're going to fund it. They believe that they can get this bird to fly, this dodo to fly. But, Howard, there's plenty of other options. We don't need a national carrier. We can get efficient people to come in and help us. We can sell it. Whether we can sell it, we can give it away. And we can get someone to come here and operate a decent service. But it just seems to be an obsession that no one can seem to get over or fully understand.
Yeah, it is. It's really incredible. Would you put Eskom in this? I mean, obviously it's not the same because we can't function without yeah. Eskom. I mean, although we actually do often function without Eskom, but that's something different. Do you think there's the same obsession in the fact that they need to control this? Slowly we are seeing a little bit of relief, but I mean, this has been going on since 2008, since the first energy crisis hit us.
I think we're easing up there. Easing up, I mean, Andris de Rijt has come in there and seems to be making some impact. The problem is that, as this recent report showed, that there was something like 5,000 people, put on, 5,000 people who were, investigated and, accused of using their positions, of rent seeking. And of corruption. Now, when there are 5,000 people in an organization, then you've got to change the whole organization. But I think there is a commitment to do so. It's going to take a long time. I mean, because this is so rotten and in such trouble. Because the other thing is that you've got, the whole reason it's in trouble is that no one's demanding their product at the moment because the economy is so in such trouble.
But nor do they want us to, which is the irony of that.
Well, listen, at the moment I haven't got electricity. We've been out since 5 o'clock this morning because a power station down the line has tripped. And all it's doing is exposing how weak the infrastructure is and how much money has to be put in, and that's going to cost a lot of money. But where they are making headway is that they are going to allow independent power suppliers to come in. But in essence, how it's a very small amount, that's going to. But they're trying. I haven't got much faith in it. It's going to take a long time. It's going to cost an enormous amount. But I think they realize the urgency of getting Eskom right. The big worry is as they start to expand, and this is another issue. When we talk about structural reforms in the country, it really means structural reforms. In other words, dropping all the kind of demands that they've had before, a lot of which are political. Mm-hmm. And therefore the big worry is that if they do start to expand this country, if they do start to increase infrastructure spending, that there must be no conditions attached to that. In other words, you can't put rules around it. If you want to build an economy, if you want to attract investment, you've got to lay out a red carpet and welcome investors. You can't give them a whole rule book to fill out, spreadsheet. You have to buy your milk from this dairy, and you have to buy your groceries 100%. From here. You do it where you can do it best. If so-and-so is not doing his work, yes, you are allowed to fire him. You don't have to.
It's so interesting. It's a shift that says, what is our business and who is our customer? And if the rest of the world's investors are our customer and South Africa is a business, well, then we've got to look at why anybody wants to do business with us. And then you look at it that way. But I'm always concerned, and I'm not going into community organizations, but I think often community organizations run the same way, that we kind of forget what our customer is, who our customer is. So South Africa needs to look at the rest of the world and say, well, if South Africa is competing with India, then what do we have to offer to bring people here rather than go there? But I just am not sure. It's that simple. But I don't know if that simplicity of vision translates to anything.
No. We're still very ideologically minded. Instead of saying we need growth, listen, if we go look at that budget, to put the budget, you don't have to be an economist. You don't even have to understand. You need to be an accountant. What happens is we are spending more than we're earning, full stop. And in order to bridge that gap, we are borrowing. So the gap that we have between what we're earning and what we're spending, we go out and borrow. Now, you can't do that indefinitely. Somewhere down the line, you have to either reduce your expenditure or increase your revenue. It comes down to that. What's happened, the shock of yesterday is that Tito promised to reduce debt within a couple of years. He's now extending it, you know, right through for the next 5 years, we're going to get more debt. And the more debt you have, the more interest you pay, the more that takes away from the revenue you earn. You know, that's simple household economics. Yeah, it's household economics. You know it when you get your salary, you can't spend more than you earn. And it comes down to how are we going to increase the revenue? You know, how do we do that? And it's exactly what you said. You've got to open up and say, what do we do well here? What can we do here that the rest of the world needs? And how can we do it in a way that makes us efficient, that we can beat off our competitors when people want to deal with us? And we still haven't formulated that plan.
David, are there any signs of that should give us a bit of optimism or hope?
The problem is we're waiting for the detail. They're in the right direction. Right. That's what I liked about Tito yesterday. He knows what he has to do. He went to the civil servants and said, you know, for the last 5 odd years, we've been increasing your wages way above inflation. That's fine if you get a productivity increase. You know, if you go to get your driver's license and you rock up there and a half an hour later, you're out. You know, that's increasing productivity, not 3 days later or having to take a day off work. So, you know, if we can increase productivity, by all means, increase wages. But he's gone back to the public service and said, listen, we're not increasing your wages for the next 3 years. And believe me, that's going to cause a lot of eruptions with the trade unions and with civil servants or the public service. So he was very bold, and he's adamant that he's going to stick to it. And that's the right attitude. So if we can go along that line, and he wants to take something like 300 billion out of expenditure over the next 3 years. If he can achieve that, there's a lot of skepticism out there. Yes, then he's on the right track. And that will also be against creating an environment in which hopefully our businesses can prosper. So there's a lot of wishes there. We've got to see, you know, I always say the PowerPoint presentation is easy. It's delivering on it, the details, yeah.
And the one thing, you know, as well that we could add to that is the confidence that corruption is being dealt with. And we are seeing signs there, but very, very slow.
Very slow, and it goes right down. There's a culture of entitlement here. You know, if I'm a mineer, I've got an office, you know, I've got a desk, and I can give business out, I want my return. And that's right through. That's what we saw. We saw that in Eskom. That's what we've seen in Eskom. Yeah. And you've got to start that mindset. You've got to change that mindset where people understand, listen, we're working for the good of the country. You know, this is my job, is to make sure that everybody has electricity, because it's important that they have it, not only because they can watch TV, but they can actually do their business.
Absolutely right. David Shapiro, thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Fascinating conversation, quite sobering, but nevertheless very important.